to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Welcome to Shoot the Defence on FNX, brought to you by My Sportswear, Youth Energy and Save Association. I'm your host, Stel, and this is a very special edition of Shoot the Defence because on the line is none other than USA soccer legend and pundit, Alexi Lalas. So, Alexi, welcome to Shoot the Defence. How are you this afternoon? I should say morning.
It's morning, yeah. I am in Los Angeles traffic, notorious Los Angeles traffic, making my way to the Fox Sports Studios where I work, getting ready actually to talk about our friends Liverpool as they continue on this quest in Champions League. So there's always another game, which is wonderful for guys like ourselves that work in the game, and I just come off of a big weekend of MLS, and we just keep on doing them.
That's right. It's derby weekend, isn't it?
You got it. Yep, so I'll be, I don't have to go anywhere. I'm staying here in Los Angeles against San Jose, but then we got Seattle and Portland, and everybody is playing against their big rivals, whether they are true traditional rivals or not. So it's a big weekend of MLS, too.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about yourself, Alexis. You studied at Rutgers University, where, incidentally, the first game of soccer was played there back in 1869. Now, was becoming a pro footballer your dream?
Wow, somebody's been on Wikipedia. Okay, no, listen, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, Michigan, and I grew up idolizing hockey players because hockey is the law in Michigan. You got to play hockey and you got to follow hockey. So my wall was papered and postered with hockey players and musicians, and so music and hockey were a big part of my life, but I also grew up going back and forth between Detroit, Michigan, and Athens, Greece. My father's Greek, and so I was that proverbial kid playing sandlot soccer, albeit in Athens, Greece. So I was this redhead American kid that didn't speak a lick of Greek, going down to the sandlot and just kind of sitting on the sidelines and eventually working my way into being able to play, and that's how I started, and then I came back and did what all kids do with mom and dad coaching and youth teams and juice boxes and orange peels at halftime, and then continued on through, and soccer was always a part of my life, but it was a part of my life along with hockey and other sports and music and all this other stuff, but I never grew up thinking that I was going to be a professional soccer player or play in World Cups or do the things that I did, only because that wasn't the norm. That wasn't what American kids growing up in the 70s and 80s necessarily had aspirations to do.
So you said that your dad's Greek. Which team did he support?
So my dad supported Ike. And so then when my brother and I had to pick our teams, it was all kind of based off of color. So Ike, the yellow team, I went with Olympiakos, the red team, and my brother went with Panathinaikos, the green team.
Ah, excellent. That must have been an interesting rivalry there.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good time. I mean, I really had the best of both worlds, going back and forth between Greece and the United States. And then, as you mentioned, I went off to university, which is a pathway that a lot of American players take, was exposed to a higher level of play and against a higher level of competition. And from there, I was seen by the national teams and just continued on. But even when I was in college, I didn't necessarily see a life as a professional soccer player as something that could happen, even though I was having success.
That's right. But the thing is, I understand you were called up to the 92 Olympic team. Is that right?
Yep. So that was international experience. The Olympics in 92 in Barcelona, as we know, the Olympics at that point, actually, that was the first Olympics where it was started to be under 23. And so that was a wonderful experience to get that international tournament. And I came back from that, and look, life is different about timing, and I had some very, very good timing in that, as many of your listeners will know, the United States hosted the World Cup in 1994. Well, leading up to the 94 World Cup, we had put together a team, and a lot of the players had opportunities playing professional, and so what ended up happening is, for the 2 years prior to the World Cup, and this was after the Barcelona Olympics, We went into residency in Southern California preparing for that 94 World Cup. So for 2 years, basically, if you look at my generation, we have a lot of caps. It's because all we did was travel around the world for 2 years and home base it in Los Angeles playing international games. And so when I stepped on the field in 1994 in the World Cup, not professional club, I did it completely backwards because you're supposed to go to a club, you have success, they recognize you, then you get to call to the national team, and then if you're really good enough, you get to play in a World Cup. Well, I had no club experience when I stepped on the field in 1994. All of my experience was international.
Right. So when you mentioned the residency program, is that the whole traveling and getting the experience at international level, was that part of the program?
Yes. Yeah, so we based out of Mission Viejo, California, with a training facility, and through the week we would train there twice a day, and then we would go to different parts of the world, and certainly we're around our country, and this was back when there weren't blackout days or anything like that, so you just kind of took national game team games whenever they came, and we would play different international games, and it was all part of the plan, because for guys like myself, as I said, and guys like Kobe Jones, we didn't have professional teams. There were some players that were playing in Europe that would come back into the camp and would augment the camp, and certainly were there in the summer. But for most of us, we were just basing out of Los Angeles, and that was our professional type of situation.
Right, right. So when USA 94 rolled around, you'd never played the professional game. So what was that like for you?
Well, in one sense, it was okay because all I did was play international games. So I already had a resume of whatever 50 plus international appearances, and so the fact that you're playing against different types of competition, different nationalities each and every time, that didn't faze me. I think where the pressure came was, as any host nation would feel, is you are the host, and you are a United States team that had only qualified for that previous 1990 World Cup after 50 years away from the World Cups, and still an emerging soccer nation, and the pressure to get out of the group, which is kind of recognized as, you know, that's success. And so we knew that we had opportunities individually, but we also knew that we had a responsibility to show the world that we were getting better as a soccer-playing nation, and that meant getting out of our group, which was not an easy task. And that's where the pressure, I think, came for all of us, is to not embarrass ourselves, our country, or most importantly, our sport in terms of the eyes of the world.
Absolutely. And you played under Bora Milutinovic. I understand he's a bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, he is a man that changed my life. He Right. had belief in me when others didn't, and he gave me the opportunity to play when there were plenty of people that told him he was crazy. Speaking of crazy, he is crazy. I love him. He is a dear friend, and I owe him a tremendous amount of thanks and gratitude for the opportunity that he gave me. He speaks five languages, none of them really good. He speaks in sometimes in riddles. He is this combination of Yoda and Yogi Berra, and Yogi Bear for that matter. He can be incredibly frustrating as a person and as a coach, and yet he was the perfect person for me at that time, and he changed the way that I look at the game and the way that I look at myself in the game, and I learned a tremendous amount from him, although certainly at times I was pulling my hair out, and he frustrated me and others time and time again, but there was a method to the madness.
Absolutely, and you've just mentioned your hair. Do you still have that bag of hair?
No, I do have the bag of hair. As you know, we change on the outside. I'm still a mess on the inside. You know, like never has so much been done with a mockum of talent and some hair care products and a guitar. And I lived the power of what a World Cup can do to an individual in 1994, and it changed my life forever. One of the reasons why I'm talking to you today is because of that summer, and it opened doors and gave me opportunities, and I milked it for all it was worth and had a blast doing it. I burned it at both ends for so many years because of that exposure and because of that platform. I knew exactly what I was doing in terms of imaging. As I told you earlier, I grew up doing a lot of music, playing music, recording music, performing music, and following music, and a lot of the way that artists and bands brand themselves and the aesthetic and the optics of how you say something as important as what you say, and the costuming and the theater. I took that to heart, and so I knew what I was doing. It was manufactured in the sense, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't authentic and genuine in terms of the way that I presented myself to the world. But look, it's a stage just like any other stage, and you practice, and then you take it in front of people, and you want to have that connection, and you want to have that interaction. You want to have that reaction from people, and if not, then go out and play on Sunday afternoon in front of nobody. But I consider myself a performer and an entertainer. I always have. I don't make any apologies for it. It doesn't mean, once again, that I'm not honest, genuine, and authentic in the things that I do and I say, but I recognize that I'm in front of people, and I'm there to give a show.
Absolutely. Well, look, I know you're an entertainer, so, and I'm not going to ask you to sing what you did on Badil and Skinner's show all those years ago, but tell me about your move to Padova. How did that come about? And given your lack of experience, was the technical and tactical aspect of Italian football a shock?
Yeah, I mean, it was, everything was a shock. It's like I said, I had never been on the books of a professional club, and also, as I said, those doors started to open up, and so after the 94 World Cup, I had opportunities in Germany, England, and in Italy. Germany for a team called Bochum, and in Italy, or in England, a team that you know, Coventry. Now, this was before Bosman, this was before the opening of the European community, and this was still at a time where Serie A was everything. It was the most money, it was the most prestige, it was the most attention. It was the place to go. And so there really was no doubt that I was going to go there. If you're going to do it, then do it big and do it bold. And that, for me, to be that first American in the modern age to go to Serie A at a time when Serie A was the place to be, that meant a lot. Now, I get there, and it is this incredible fishbowl of 24 hours, 7 days a week of living the life of a professional soccer player, and it was eye-opening. It was a whole new world for me, and I was very, very different than anything that they had seen before, but I was also cognizant of the fact that I needed to make sure that I presented myself in a way that wasn't detrimental to American soccer once again. Now, I could be myself and all the different things inside and out that I am and the unique aspect of it, but I still was very aware and always have been aware that if you don't match it with some good play on the field, then you're just a clown. And I didn't want to leave that impression. So I wanted to make sure that I was good on the field and that I left a good impression of American soccer players so it wasn't scorched earth, if you will, for future generations.
Interestingly enough, yourself, Goran Vlahovic, and Michael Creek were also at Padova at the same time. All of you were non-Italians, and they both ended up playing in Greece, didn't they?
Yep, it's pretty amazing. I mean, so that was back when you could have three foreign players per team. And look, whether it was playing with the guys that I was playing with, you mentioned Goran Vlahovic and Michel Creek and these types of players, internationals, or the actual competition week to week. I mean, especially for a center back, defending the best players in the world every single Sunday. And so one minute I'm running around chasing after Zola. Then I'm running around chasing after Gullit. Then I'm running around chasing after Ravanelli and Vialli. Then I'm running around Signori. And then every single, Balbo, Fonseca, you know, all these different incredible players. I learned very, very quickly, and I, not only did I become a better soccer player for that experience, but I became a better person just for being in that fishbowl, learning a language, understanding that culture, and having to adapt to a whole different way of life very, very quickly.
It's a massive learning curve, isn't it, going there? Massive.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
Well, look, let's talk MLS, a competition you know all about, having been there, done that, worn the T-shirt, and probably seen loads of T-shirts with your face on. I've actually made a bit of money betting on MLS games to have three or more goals in.
Wow, you're the one.
Yeah, I'm happy about that. I'm happy about that. The thing is, mate, people like to criticise the standard of defending out there, but the quality is improving year on year, not just in MLS, but also USL and NASL.
Oh, yeah. I think that the league every year gets bigger and better. And it's a labor of love for a lot of us. It is la cosa nostra. It's our thing. And I know that it's not perfect, but I will love it till the day that I die, warts and all. And it is getting better. It's getting on and off the field. The perception of it is getting better. It's a fun league to watch. It makes no apologies that it's different in certain senses than the rest of the world. But I think that this is a league that, if it was a stock, this is one that you want to get in on, because I am very, very bullish. This is one that's going up. It's not one that's already established. This is one that's only going to get bigger and better because of, because the people involved, but also because of the emerging market that is the United States and Canada and North America right now. It is something that's pretty special, and I know I sound like I'm a salesman for it, but the reality is that I think that as you've discovered, there's some very, very interesting aspects of it, and going forward, I think a lot more people are going to look at it as something that they at least include on their palette of soccer that they watch.
That's right. You don't sound like a salesman to me, because I completely agree with everything you say. I mean, I'm looking at the way that interest in soccer has continued to grow in the US, and especially at grassroots level. I don't think European soccer is actually light years ahead. I know they're getting the fundamental things right in America, and truth be told, the youth structure out there is actually putting many British teams to shame. The thing is, when you see the likes of Neymar being bought for £200 million, do you think the wage cap and designated player rules are actually halting the progress of MLS sides?
Well, I mean, I think that you have to look at, first off, the progress that has been made in terms of the amount of money spent. I think we're at a point right now where the amount of money and the type of money that teams are now being that teams now have at their disposal enables them to go for those mid-level players, those players that in the past would have been lost to Mexico or some of the secondary leagues in Europe. I think MLS can compete. The designated player situation, look, anybody can go out and spend a lot of money on a well-known player. That doesn't take any talent. It just takes money. And it's wonderful that MLS teams are able to do it. It's not in the same league, but let's be honest, who is in the same league as Barcelona and PSG at this point? I mean, that is ridiculous amounts of money. And that's not going to happen for a long time. But I do believe that, and you can attest to this, with all due respect, the reason why the migration to England happened is not because of the weather or the food. It is because they did a wonderful job in branding that league, and they did a wonderful job in surrounding that league and in incorporating incredibly rich people in that league. Yep. That made it the destination that it is. And I believe that the same kind of migration can happen to North America for the sport if you are able to give players, obviously, the same or better types of money, but also make sure that the perception, their perception of themselves and the perception from outside of what they are doing starts to change. And when that happens, then that migration will happen. And we saw it as, I mean, we can use it as a template, what happened in England, and I know it's a little bit different when it comes to North America, but I think that that can happen, and when it does, it will be a destination that players want to go to for themselves and their family. If they can make just as much money, they're not going to suffer in terms of their international career, in terms of the perception. They're safe. They're going to get paid. Their kids can go to school. They can have all the advantages that exist in North America. I think it would be a destination that many, many players would love to go to.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong. And the thing is, when you look at the affiliate program between MLS and USL clubs, how successful do you think that's been so far?
Well, so for your listeners, I don't know how much they know, but there is this incredible, I don't call it a fight, but it's heated at times between the different leagues. So we have the pyramid, if you will, is always changing, because we don't have promotion relegation. So you have MLS as the one sanctioned Division I league. Then you have the NASL and USL, both sanctioned as Division II leagues. There's no promotion relegation between any of them. But there is an affiliation and a partnership between MLS and USL, which puts the squeeze on NASL. I do think if you take away the politics of it, I think from a practical standpoint, it's been important, because now you have MLS teams that have affiliates that either are branded likewise as the Red Bulls too, or whatever it ends up being, or they are just loosely affiliated. But there's a place for the developing talent, and that talent that, as you mentioned, is now coming from developmental academies and academy systems, and you have that vertical integration, and you can give players the opportunity to play, and players within that system, and so you have that type of top to bottom type of system that we talk about so much, that is so important when it comes to building not just a first team, but a club from top to bottom. So all of those things I think are good, but I think the interesting thing going forward is to see how this all shapes out when it comes to who sanctioned what, how the interaction happens, if there ends up ever being promotion relegation, and in what form that takes. But as we talked about earlier, it's always going to be unique. It's always going to be American. For some people, that's part of the problem. For me, I own it, and I love the fact that it is uniquely American in the way that we go about things on and off the field.
That's right. So, VAR, it's been in place since the 5th of August in MLS. How do you think that's going?
Swimmingly. I think it's gone great, actually. I'll be honest, I was skeptical to begin with, but in seeing it implemented both this summer when I saw it in the Confederations Cup, which certainly had its hiccups, and it's going to have hiccups, but then also seeing it the way that they have unveiled it and the way that it has gone here in MLS. First off, it's much less intrusive than people realize, and so the stoppages are few and far between, and that's by design just in terms of when and where and how they can actually access video review. I think that they've done a good job of explaining it to the messengers, if you will, guys like myself and others that work in each and every week talking about the games, so that we are up to date and we understand how it's used and we're able to explain it to the viewer. One of my biggest problems or concerns going in was that it was going to make a game that I love, because it is subjective, because it's not black and white, because there is that gray area, I think that's what, for me, makes the game beautiful, that it was going to take some of that out.
Right.
It hasn't. If anything, it has actually given us more to argue about and to debate, and that's stuff that's music to my ears. So I love the fact that that we continue to ultimately, we're not, until robots are actually making calls, we are still ultimately debating someone's and a human being's subjective type of decision. And it's fun to see how this has come in. And there's an element of just getting the calls, the ones that we can, getting them right. And I think if you look at the way it's been used over the last couple of weeks in MLS, when it has been used correctly, and it has ultimately resulted in the right call being made, which isn't always necessary in my book, but I know for a lot of people, they want to get the call right. And in the instances that it's been used, for the most part, I think that they have done. And it's going to get better and better. And I do believe that it's that MLS, and to be fair, now it's in Italy and the Netherlands and Australia has been using it. It's going to be used by everybody eventually.
Well, that's reassuring to hear, because we saw how misused it was in the Confederations Cup. So let's just hope that it continues. So while we're talking about VAR, it's going to be implemented in the Premier League, and about the Premier League. It's been an exciting start to the campaign, but while it's too early to pass judgment on any team, who do you expect to see challenging for the title this season?
Well, let's see. So Manchester United's off to the races, and everything's back. Happy days are here again, all that kind of stuff, except they haven't really played anybody. Is that the general consensus over there? Is that what's going on? I want to make sure I'm following the narrative from your perspective.
Well, put it so, a lot of people are saying that it's only West Ham and Swansea, but others like me are saying, well, you know, these are the teams that United dropped points against last season, so it's an improvement.
Yeah, no, but there's also, there is a swagger. There is a swagger about them, a swagger, and not a manufactured swagger, in that I do believe it's a genuine swagger. Now, it's a long season, as we know. Look, I'm off to do the Liverpool Champions League game, and that's a team that right now has incredible stories given the Coutinho situation right now. And until that gets sorted, that's hard to even judge what they are going to be and how they are going to be it. So that's interesting. I mean, the Arsenal soap opera, the soap opera that is Arsenal, just continues and just is wonderful in terms of giving me things to talk about. I can't wait to see how it all unfolds. I think ultimately it will still end the way that every soap opera ends, where there is heartache and drama and a cliffhanger type of situation. Man City, I think, which is rightfully made the changes that they needed to make, but still in that whole Patrick Vieira type of romantic philosophy, I think at times could be incredible, but also when they're standing on that philosophy, at times could put themselves in some problems. Who else are we talking about here? Do we miss anybody
Tottenham?
Tottenham, I mean, look, Spurs, I mean, do we just wait until they finally get into the stadium that they want? I mean, is it that much of an albatross around their neck going forward? I don't know. I mean, they're still incredible quality when you look at them on the field. But I think it's going to be the usual suspects. That whole Leicester thing was wonderful, but we all know it was an anomaly and an aberration and a wonderful one to see, and just this fairy tale that's not going to repeat itself. So I think you're going to see the usual suspects back screaming and yelling and fighting for that top four spot. And when that music stops, there's going to be still some big teams that don't have a chair.
Great stuff. And on a final note, Alex, for the benefit of our Arsenal supporting listeners, what can you tell them about Stan Kroenke? I'm not sure you're aware, but he's actually public enemy number two at the moment, with Wenger being public enemy number one.
Yeah, how dare he run his business actually as a business? Look, the way that he is viewed over there seeps into at least from the soccer community's perception of him over here. And so you can't be involved in international soccer and not expect all of that to be fodder. It's all part. So just because you're doing something on the other side of the world doesn't mean it's out of sight, out of mind. As a matter of fact, I would submit to you that American soccer fans are some of the most educated in the world because they are exposed to so much soccer, and for many years they've had to actually go and find it. Now it just comes to us in incredible masses. But when it comes to Kroenke right now, I mean, we deal with him from a Colorado Rapids standpoint, which is a team that is in disarray right now. They just fired their coach. There's still a question as to who and what they want to be going forward, and whether they actually even want to compete in this MLS type of scenario. And then from the Arsenal perspective, look, you build up a super club, right? And that's all fine and well, but if and when you don't maintain that super club, don't blame anybody if you are then judged against that level of that super club that has been in the past. And it's the same for Manchester United or anybody else. You have conditioned your fans, your supporters, your season ticket holders, and the world in general to expect the best in terms of the quality that you put on the field and in terms of the victories that you put up in the wins-loss column. And so when people start to compare you to the past and say, well, this is not what I expect, that's actually a good thing, but you got to live up to it. And when you don't, you're going to get hammered. And if you don't want to be a super club anymore, then fine. Come out and say, we are not that super club anymore. And then see and then see how the reaction is. So it's all fun. When it comes to Kroenke, I mean, I think that he has the same reputation here that he has over there. And it is a business to him. And he doesn't care what anybody says, obviously. He's a very private and doesn't talk a whole lot. But he's going to run that business the way he sees fit. And he's going to look at it first and foremost as a business. It doesn't mean that he doesn't like the game. It doesn't mean that he isn't competitive. But ultimately, he makes his decisions based on what's good for that business and for the future good of that business.
That's right. Well, look, they need a central defender. Do you fancy dusting your boots off and putting them back on?
They should be so lucky. Actually, years ago, I remember coming over in December of what would have been, 1992 or something, and I had about a week trial at Arsenal. And this was before I was anybody, and I certainly didn't have a work permit. I didn't have any full international experience. I had just come off the Olympics in Barcelona. And I was just, like I said, before that whole residency program happened, I was just bumming around. And Bob McNabb hooked me up with a trial. He was an old Arsenal player. And I'll never forget going every day to London Colney. And let's see. So it was Ian Wright, Tony Adams, and Paul Mercer that would pick me up every day from my hotel and take me to training, and it was so interesting and fun. And as we've spoken about, it was my first experience even in a professional club. It didn't work out, but obviously I went on to bigger and better things. But I had a wonderful time there, and Arsenal since then has given me as a TV personality incredible opportunities and fodder and grist for the mill, if you will. And I thank them for it every day that I get to talk about them.
Well, there you go. So there's the long-running joke about Wenger almost signing players. You could have signed for Arsenal. There you go. Well, Alex, it's been an
it's been
an absolute pleasure talking to you, sir. It's great having someone such as yourself with that kind of caliber experience. I really hope you can come back on the show at some point. It'll be great to have you back.
I love it, and I wish you the best of luck, and any time, it'll be a pleasure.
Thank you, Alexi. All the best. You have a great weekend.
See ya.
All the best. Take care. Bye.